Would you introduce yourselves, please?
I'm Anand Wilder from the band Yesayer.
I'm Ira Wolf Tuton from Yesayer.
Chris Keating from Yesayer.
All right, we got your 2006, we got your Brooklyn. I like experimental rock. We're going to blow up genres. I love blowing up genres. Experimental rock. Well, man, we got a Petri dish and it's in our band. let's see. Technically Brooklyn band, but Baltimore High School, fifth album. I think we're done. I don't think there's anything more left to talk about except everything. So I like to start this. I call this the enemy breath mint question.
And are you wearing two pairs of glasses?
No, they came this way. What are you amazed in all this time that you've never been asked?
I'm amazed, now that I have the microphone, that people are still asking us any questions at all.
That's an answer.
Yeah.
It's learned written that it all started to happen at South by Southwest 2007. So I've been going since 2004. But do you remember, like, when you were just young chillin' and you were going to this big old festival in Austin, Texas, and you were all nervous and you were signed to an indie label and stuff, do you remember, like, anything about that and saying, wow, this is friggin' insane, we're playing 16 gigs in sweaty weather? And
the first time, we only played two gigs to pretty much not very many people. So, the first time we played a house party, and then we played a weird theater. Yeah, we did the non-official. Maybe one of them was official, but one of them was, they were sort of house parties. So, and it wasn't really until the second time. So we went through there thinking that we were going to make it, I guess. And then subsequently played a lot of shows to know people all over the country. Yeah, we had fun, though.
That was the most fun.
We talked about
revisionist history, though.
Yeah. We had fun, and it wasn't until the following, probably South by a year later, that then
but
people
didn't,
cared.
So didn't the article come out that REA wrote that was like seven bands from South by Southwest that will matter?
Oh, did you get one of those?
Yeah.
Oh,
so it
that's
was like
a kiss of death.
So it was one of our yeah.
Now we're seven buzz bands that were
yeah.
Now we're one of seven bands that matter.
Yeah. I like hooks. I like harmonies. I like pop, but not pop as in pop. So you have said that with this new record, he said, segueing into something relevant, "Don't bore us, get to the chorus." What the hell is experimental?
I have
rock?
Never understood what power pop means.
Well, yeah.
What are you saying that it means?
Powerful and popular.
What the fuck?
That was Pete Townsend. Yes, you can. There's a lot of power pop that never went anywhere.
That never went anywhere. Yeah, so it's really a style that's, you know, it's like big stars, like power pop.
Yeah, theoretically, although, yep. Yeah, big stars. But here's the thing, all kidding aside.
Replacements or something?
Yeah, you make this record.
Weezer.
It is hook laden, it is harmony laden, it sounds really good, and we'll get to how that was done. We'll talk about the studios and stuff. But more importantly, you know, being an experimental rock band and, you know, having association with Animal Collective and all of this stuff that's out there, isn't it like disappointing the fans to make a hook-laden record? Isn't that kind of,
brave? No, we've always had hooks on records, man. I mean, we always like that stuff. So it seemed to make sense to me. We just sort of got rid of some of the swirly-whirly stuff.
And the songs are just shorter.
Yeah, shorter. They're more direct. We tried to be under 3 minutes, tried to cut out sort of languid, atmospheric intros, because we've had many records that had that, so it was a challenge.
But aren't you killing your experimental rock cred by doing that?
We already killed that, I mean, like, yeah, 10 years ago when we put out Odd Blood.
Anybody on an airplane that ever asked me what kind of band I'm in, I just say I'm in a pop band. I've always said that.
Doesn't that kill people, though?
I don't know. It's also just
a non-descriptor. It doesn't really describe any kind of sound. I usually just say we're heavy metal.
but in a genre-based world, to be a band that's just making good songs, I mean, you know, isn't that dangerous?
Yeah, it's definitely hurt us.
It's definitely hurt us.
I mean, most bands just make the same record over and over and over again. We, for some reason, keep changing it up.
How dare you?
And
you can't be the Hanson Brothers if you do that.
Oh.
the world has changed. And, you know, in the old days to have home studios, you would have needed a big fat Ampex and all sorts of stuff. But now all the toys are there. But what is, and I'm going to be serious for saying, what is amazing about this record is that considering how it was produced and done in three home studios, how well it falls together. So what's the telegraph that you use as you're kind of all percolating away and doing what you're doing, because you also all theoretically write songs together?
I think we start separately, and then, you know, you just kind of have something that doesn't sound very good at first, and then you just try to work on it. And just like any other, have you ever heard any David Bowie demos? They don't sound very good. You know, they're pretty rough. And you're like, oh, there's a cool idea in there. And then, but, you know, we just, with technology these days, you're able to get sounds that you'd want. You're able to stock your home studio with compressors and a couple preamps that you couldn't have done in the 70s because you were having, exactly like you said, huge tape reels and everything. And so,
I mean, our process is kind of unchanged. It's like,
we've always sort of done this.
We always have demos, and we're always, I mean, the last record, we like got a producer. And
we can talk about Warren.
Yeah, but essentially, we took all of our equipment and moved it into a little production studio room about the size of this bus, smaller than this bus. And one of us would record while the other person's playing, and then the other person would record while the other person's playing, and you just layer stuff on top of it. And then, you know, this one, the only thing that was different about this is we really were completely on our own. We didn't have a record label giving us money, so we were just investing.
Yeah, nobody
all of
forcing
our own.
Us to spend money on stuff we know we
don't
need.
Yeah, no one
saying,
you
which
need
is
to get
nice.
A producer now.
Yeah.
So we employed my intern, and he.
See, thank you for taking me down.
Yeah. And he basically helmed the project on his computer, and he had all the files and everything. And
so his role was truly to take everything you did, lay it in, and then work with you to give you what you wanted.
Yeah, and then also he's doing a lot of file management. So if we get to a certain point with a song and realize, oh, I really preferred it 2 months ago, he can say, oh, well, I can just pull up the July 7th version, which I saved.
Exactly.
don't be so organized, though. I mean, you're killing me.
We're not that organized.
No, we're not. You have to work with someone who is.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, no, but that helps.
But we also allowed him to, oh, if he just wants to play a little flourish here on some strings.
Well,
okay,
he also did,
great.
Right?
Go
because
it.
He, you know, you did have other instrumentation on this record, did you not?
Yes.
Yeah, we got.
You brought in some players, did you not?
We've always brought in players. The horn player is Walter Fancourt. We brought him in on the last cycle as well. Met him on touring. We were touring with a band he's in called Reptar. We brought a violin player in and his brother, the trombonist.
The Schramm brothers.
The Schramm brothers.
And then, I mean, really, the one thing we did, I think, that was harder without the professional big studio was I took all my equipment over to our current touring drummer's practice space and recorded drums.
Drums are hard.
Drums are the one thing that drums you need to have a space where you can set up the drums, and you need to have multiple mics going in at the same time if you want that live drum sound.
Yep.
And but we figured it out.
When the fans kind of go, why didn't you just stick to music?
You know, most of them don't. Most of them are very appreciative, and they like the fact that we wear our politics on our sleeves. It's just the really active internet trolls who tell us to stay in their lanes.
Or the blatantly ignorant and stupid to the history of music people. People who just have never really...
don't know that Phil Oakes sang Small Circle of Friends.
Wow, forget even Phil Oakes. The Beatles mentioned politics. Yeah, they don't know who Phil Oakes is. They don't know so much. I mean, they, you know, if you ever dive into even the lyrics on the Tribe Called Quest record, if you really listen to the lyrics of any artist that you like who is halfway intelligent, they're probably referencing politics.
Probably.
And for some reason...
Even the Eagles.
Some reason...
You take it to the limit?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm always amazed that all these Bob Marley fans, they're being preached fundamentalism.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's just, it's for some reason, it's something that every nitwit can say to a musician or an artist, like, don't talk about politics. But then they also don't like politicians talking about politics. Generally, they like to... I don't know who they want. They want businessmen. I guess it's okay to be a businessman.
It's a business.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah.
You know, it's funny is we talk about the big picture politics, but And nobody is really talking about the music business politics.
Well, I'm about to.
Okay, like we could be getting health insurance through these.
Could, but labels. Like, but
we
like,
could be pooling our money instead of just letting that one artist rise to the top in the
yep.
bourgeois individualist kind of.
Yep, but you made a decision. You made a decision to go it alone. You made a decision to leave the womb, and you weren't even with the most evil labels. What was the tipping point where you just said, you know what? We'd love to have the studio advance. We'd love to have the tour money. We'd love to have the, but well, we don't really want to give up our publishing.
We never took any tour money. We've never taken.
What about publishing? Did you own that for Moment One?
We've signed deals separate from our labels for publishing. So they've always been administrative deals with a publishing house.
So what was the tipping point?
That is short term. It's because the advances weren't enough. I mean, you know, everyone has their point where they just do a calculation where if you're going to give me $300,000 right now, oh, wow, that sounds really good. If you're going to give me $100,000, well, maybe it's not worth it to give up the rights to your records in perpetuity. Well, I don't know. It just depends on, I mean, and if someone's going to only give you $50,000, then you say, well, wait a minute, we can figure that out ourselves. And why would we give up 50% of the profits, best case scenario, 50% or 80% of the profits in case of a royalty deal? You know? Yeah, it's just
so
a loan.
It's a bad loan.
So we're all parents here. That balance of being a parent and rock and roll, but also getting a child to help with lyrics and stuff. So where's that moment that it all kind of collides and you go, well, but wait, we're on the tour bus, but we have responsibility to the kids and what's the guilt factor and all that sort of stuff?
I personally feel guiltier when I'm at home not doing anything, you know.
I don't know. Being away from the separation does make the heart grow fonder, I think.
Yeah. So you're kind of like, yeah, good. I mean, to escape.
If this is about 2 weeks into the tour, these guys get to see their wives and kids, sons and daughters come out, and it's nice. I wish that my wife could come out now, like we could have timed it better, because it is that time when you start to really miss them, you know.
Right.
But at the same time, I the whole like idea of having a 9-to-5 job and the normal home life doesn't appeal to me either. I like to be doing something extraordinary, which is going out and touring around the world. I think that's pretty cool.
So I want to pose something tricky that I'll either get killed for or not. I think that a rerun can be erotic if the original version was great. Discuss.
I don't think that any rerun can be erotic.
I mean, what if the original was so effing good?
The nature of reruns is pretty, like, it seems to be the things that get rehashed over and over again by the people who have the ability to replay those things are pretty stale, right? Kind of like something that's stale just by kind of its definition and tired can't really be erotic, or maybe it can. I don't know. I'm actually starting to like look at some of those older and our sort of pornified culture. I start to look at these older pictures where, you know, gals from the 20s are just showing their ankles, and I start thinking, oh, this is pretty sexy.
Yeah.
It's pretty erotic.
I grew up watching tons of reruns of sitcoms,
my,
and
yes,
but they would, you know, the even the ones that were a little edgy, they would get shelved. They couldn't play them again.
Right, like the Seinfeld episode
Puerto
about
Day
Puerto Rican Day Parade, right?
Yeah.
You know, you can't. They banned it. So yeah. Yeah, you always end back at
they
Seinfeld.
They played All in the Family for a while. They played Sanford and Son for a while. But that was a different. It's weird. I mean, I 100% most of my pop culture is reruns growing up, which is so weird. It's like I was raised by like The Fall Guy reruns. It was not contemporary to my time.
I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich. And what it is two of your songs on the outside. There are no rules. I will play anything you're asking for. If you give me the 20-minute, you know, remix, you've used up most of your fun.